You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has spent most of her working life reporting and writing for war zones and areas of the world where existence seems most precarious. In so doing, she brings our focus to lives that, while a half a world away, are every bit as rich in spirit, perhaps more so, despite occupying a tenuous spot in the globalized economic world. Anna Botkin has covered wars on three continents and is the author of six books of nonfiction, including The World is a Carpet, where she spent a year with carpet weavers in a remote Afghan village, Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah, which documented her time with the Fulani cattlemen in Mali, West Africa. Her latest book shares the story of a community of Senegalese fishermen on the African west coast of the Atlantic. In the port of Joal, the fisheries have been exploited by international fishing fleets, affected by rising sea temperatures and global warming, and a government more concerned with the economics of fishing than the plight of its fishermen. In her latest book, Fisherman's Blues, A West African Community at Sea, Anna Botkin lyrically describes a resilient and resourceful community dealing with an environmental and economic catastrophe with stubbornness, faith, and grace. Anna Botkin is a member of the Tulsa Artist Fellowship while she works on her first novel. She joins me again on Studio Tulsa. Anna Botkin, and welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me back.
What interested you in this West African fishing community? I know you did a book on cattle ranchers in Mali. What interested you in this Senegalese fishing community?
All my work is focused on other ways of looking at the world. So I was working in Mali with a family of nomadic Fulani cowboys because I wanted to know what it is like to spend your lifetime walking, experiencing the world at 3 miles an hour in an open space, which is how we evolved. And then I thought, most of my work revolves also around boundaries. Boundaries have always been a mystery to me. Personal boundaries, metaphorical boundaries, physical boundaries, borders, state borders. I grew up behind the Iron Curtain, so I grew up in very rigid boundaries. And I thought, what would be the utmost boundary on our planet? And decided that it would be the boundary between the terraformer, the solid, and the unfathomable, the sea. So I wanted to work with people who have always traversed that border between land and sea, which also right now encompasses the border between having and not having, between antiquity and modernity. And I love West Africa as a landscape or seascape, and I wanted to spend more time in West Africa.
So why this particular community? Was there something about this is in Senegal, Joal? Is that how
that's correct.
Is that Joal is how I say it? What was particular about this particular community?
A number of things. First of all, Joal is the largest artisanal fishing port in Senegal. Senegal has three main sources of income. Gold is one of them. Fish is another. So I picked Joal partly because it was the largest artisanal fishing community in the country. There are more than 2,000 pirogues that are flagged to Joal, which is not a very large town.
It's about 50,000?
45,000, 47,000 people, mm-hmm. And most of whom live by fishing or around fishing or because of fishing. So, you know, you go to drop off your kids at daycare and you're going to be talking with mothers who are talking about fish. Another reason is most of my audience is in the United States. Joal is the place of first landfall of Portuguese slave traders in the early 15th century in 1435, so before Columbus. So there is a connection. And then, of course, it became a significant part of the triangle trade. So there is a connection between the two continents, between my audiences here and my hosts and fellow fishermen there. So that was not an insignificant reason why Joal.
So how did you end up making acquaintances with people like Captain Ndongo Sowore and Captain Mamoor Ndai. How did you meet these folks? How did you end up going out on the boats day after day? Did you just go out and ask?
Basically. You know, I've been doing this for 22 years, and I still can't wrap my mind around why people allow me to be present and to witness and to take part. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. I went to a mbar, which is a seaside gazebo, which is where traditionally fishermen hang out. Joal has more than 70. I went to one particular gazebo. It was a rainy day. A guy asked me for a ring. I said, well, I don't really know you. And he said, well, what are you doing here? And I said, well, you know, I'm looking for a captain to teach me how to fish. And he said, well, come tomorrow at 6 o'clock to the tide line.
And that was Captain Ndongo.
That was Captain Ndongo Sware.
Yeah.
We became good friends. He's a little younger than I am. Most of his crew are his sons and nephews. So, you know, it's a boat manned by boys, young boys, some as young as 12, sometimes 11, 9. And we went fishing. And later I ended up helping Ndongo's father build a pirogue. So I worked a little bit as a carpenter's apprentice with a very, very renowned master carpenter in that part of Senegal.
Describe the fishery, if you will. These are it's an artisanal fishery. You said about 2,000 pirogues. These are long boats with little outboard engines. I assume some of them are going quite far out, others maybe not going out so far. Describe the fishery, if you would.
Because the fishery itself is depleted, decimated by a combination of climate change and overfishing and systemic pillaging of the waters by foreign trawlers that practically vacuum up the bottom of the sea, mostly illegally, possibly because they pay off Senegalese government, possibly because Senegalese government simply doesn't have the means to patrol its waters, or a combination of the two.
Mm-hmm.
All in the name of our
avarice. Did you see those trawlers?
Yes, I did. And they come pretty close to shore.
So they're well within territorial limits then.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. So, you know, you would see them 5-7 miles offshore. Sometimes you would see them from the coast. At night, you could see their lights. So because the fishery is decimated, people have to go out on trips that are much longer and go much farther into the sea than 10, 15 years ago. According to the harbor master of Joal's Harbor, which keeps a kind of a tally concerning the number of fish hauled, the haul is about 10 times less than it was 10 years ago. So it's dramatic. It tied very closely to how we in the West consume fish, because, you know, fish is good for you.
Mm-hmm.
So because of the increase in Western consumption, and thereby the increase in unsustainable fishing methods, my friends, my captains have to go sometimes 20, 30 miles off coast. And we're talking, you know, boats with no below decks, just open sloops, essentially, very beautiful, very seaworthy, mostly with no life preservers of any kind, going out on trips that go from anywhere from 12 hours to 2 weeks. There are boats that go out to sea for 2 weeks and come back. They bring coolers where they store the fish. These are not high-tech trawlers that, you know, that we call them factory boats. These are just open boat, wooden
open
boats.
Open air boats that they have about 5 feet above waterline, 4 or 5 feet?
Oh, if that.
If that.
That.
Yeah, they're very long, narrow boats, right?
Very narrow, long boats, look like spindles, very beautifully painted, very lovingly taken care of, because they are the sole source of income for so many people. And of course, there is no insurance. So it's a very dangerous pursuit, because you can't insure your boat, you can't insure your net, you can't insure your motor. But, you know, I've been reading so much about fishermen's lore globally, and was dating a fisherman at one point, an American fisherman. And I learned that fishermen are such fatalists, and they take such pride in giving themselves up to the sea, I read a statistic somewhere that in Scotland, the death ratio of fishermen has not changed in the last 100 years, despite the fact that people now have GPS devices, all sorts of highfalutin life preservers, you know. So it's there is this kind of fatalistic streak. And many people liken fishing to gambling because of that fatalistic streak. You are gambling with so many things.
You're gambling on, you know, you're going out, you're spending money, and you acknowledge in the book that every time they go out, they're spending money because they're buying fuel to power the boat. He has to pay the crew something, although a lot of times it's dependent on how much they catch.
The crew gets shares, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, but you do have to buy gas oil for your fuel. You have to mend your net. You have to maintain your boat. You have to maintain yourself. You have to maintain your family.
And this is a sardines fishery for the most part.
Predominantly, especially in winter, sardine is the biggest, most coveted catch. By the way, sardine, do you know that sardine was the first fish ever canned?
That makes sense.
Napoleon's army, actually, when Napoleon was moving across Europe, he realized that his troops needed to eat and sometimes needed food to be able to carry food with them. You know, not enough cow, I guess, to pillage from villages. So one of the people who was serving him, a doctor, invented canned sardine.
So that was the first canned ration, I guess.
Exactly.
One of the things I found was really interesting was even though this fishery is depleted, the competition seems to be fierce for a dwindling resource. What I found was what a cooperative spirit between all the fishermen. You talk about, you know, Captain Dongo going out a couple of times and, you know, not catching much. Another boat would come up who'd had even less success, and he would share a few things out of his boat. Talk about that cooperative spirit between the fishermen.
It's kind of the ancestor of unions, I guess, of trade unions. Fishermen understand that there will come a day when they can no longer fish. And that day may come tomorrow. That day may come 30 years from now. So there is this unwritten code of conduct that if a fellow fisherman asks you for fish, you give, because one day it will be you. Or that if there are elders greeting you, retired fishermen greeting you on the shore, you bring some fish to these retired fishermen. And then they may do with that fish whatever they need to do. They can sell it and pay their electric bill. They can have their families cook it. They can do whatever. That doesn't matter. What matters is the recognition. There is a beautiful Wolof proverb. Wolof is the main language spoken, sort of lingua franca spoken in Senegal. It says Nyofar, which means we're all in it together. So that idea of Nyofar is extremely alive in the fishing community. And I also was told in the taxi community, you also have to pay your union dues, because who knows when your motor on your, you know, 1965 Peugeot is going to give out finally, and you will be out of work. Something that in our political wars here in the United States, we often lose sight of, the idea of supporting one another.
Yeah. And I was really struck by how on their own this fishing community was, given that it's one of Senegal's three big industries. Mm-hmm. There's no Coast Guard to go out and take time to go look for missing fishermen. Mm-hmm. The only regulations that come from the government are the ones that say, okay, you can't fish here. You know, I mean, it's a real.
The government is basically fleecing the fishermen.
Yeah, I find it interesting for it being one of their three largest industries.
Well, you know, capitalism. Just as poor people in the United States are unprotected, poor people in Senegal are unprotected. So again, you know, to a large extent, I think the story I'm telling is a story about how we can choose to look out for one another, how we can choose to be kind and loving toward one another.
Yeah. My guest today is Anna Botkin, a writer and journalist. She's a Tulsa Arts Fellow, and her latest book is titled Fisherman's Blues, A West African Community at Sea. It's published by Riverhead. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. One of the most interesting things about this book is how you describe the rituals the beliefs, the superstitions that go with this fishing community. You spend a lot of time in the book describing this, and it's really some of the most interesting stuff. You describe attending a sacrifice to the ocean. Fishing had been bad, and what was that ritual like?
One of the things that I'm unsure about, and I am unsure about many things, is the separation between belief and reality. Because if you and I believe something, then that becomes part of our reality, our shared reality. So when I, as an outsider, step into a community that shares a set of certain beliefs, then my life, as well as the life of this community, will be affected by the beliefs, regardless of what I personally believe in or don't believe in. So because faith and ritual and what we would call magic are such palpable and significant parts of the daily life in Ajwal, they are a significant part in the book. When the harbor master of Ajwal realized that there was so little fish coming into the harbor, he went to a local sorcerer and asked the local sorcerer to create a ritual that would bring fish to the sea. The sorcerer had been expecting the harbor master. He said that he had been having visions about the sea. So the ceremony involved a massive feast, some of which of, among other things, fish, some of which was given back to the sea. So the fish returned to the water in deep-fried form, a lot of which was given to about 200 or 300 people in attendance of the feast, mostly older people and women who work in the harbor, because women work in the harbor a lot. There are a lot of the middle women and hustlers in the harbor are women. And then there was this amazing moment. Halfway through the sacrifice, the sorcerer brought a bottle of sweet wine and poured that wine into the harbor. And the harbor water is slimy. It runs with fuel, it runs with refuse, it runs with everything that is brought to the harbor.
It's not a beach.
It's not a beach, no, it's not a beach. So he's standing at the lip of the sea and he pours this red fortified wine into the sea, and then he tosses the bottle into the sea underhand. And all of a sudden, people begin to rush into the water. And some of them tear off their clothes. Some of them just run into the water in their clothes. Women are ululating. There is a sense of ecstasy.
It's like a cathartic release.
It was a cathartic release. And so one interesting thing that I had read before coming to Ajwal actually was an account of what happened in what today is Senegal, in Saint-Louis, which was the capital of colonial French West Africa when France abolished slavery. And the description in a book by Martin Klein, who is a historian specifically focusing on the slave trade in West Africa and slavery by white people in West Africa, was a cathartic diving into the water. And I kind of relived that or re-saw that in real life. And what struck me was this is such a primal way of expressing joy and hope. So for me, it was like experiencing or witnessing something immensely sacred and immensely old. And I thought, well, you know, if I were the sea, I'd barf up some sardines.
You write that in the book. And it doesn't hurt that the very next day you went out to sea,
yes,
you ran into a huge school of sardines.
We had a good day.
Yeah. And I know you were asking the crew, says, you know, mm-hmm, what do you think of this? You know, does it and I know you ask that a lot, you know, because you would hear talk of genies, of magic. Some of it obviously sounds like superstition, you know, fishermen superstitions, but it's all tied up into superstitions, beliefs, rituals. And I think you were trying to make sense of that. What were the fishermen's reaction to this ceremony? And then the very next day, the sea was bountiful.
One of my crewmates said, well, I'm not sure if it was the ceremony itself that made the sea plentiful or the fact that we believe in the ceremony that made us have a good haul. And for me, I think bringing attention to these ceremonies and bringing attention to how magic is used is another way of looking at our own prejudices and superstitions and how our magic is used. You know, every day I come home from whenever I enter my home, I go and wash my hands. I have no idea what's in the water. I don't know if my hands are actually becoming cleaner and my vegetables from after I wash them. But this is my juju, right? This is my belief. I grew up with it. And so we all grew up with these.
And we have science that says something about it.
But still. Science presupposes that water is clean, and I'm not so sure. Yeah. You know, science didn't go into my tap in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So who knows what I'm, you know, what kind of heavy metals I'm actually putting on my hands every time I wash them. But I am a firm believer that this is a ritual I must perform, and I do it. And when I leave the studio and come home, I will wash my hands. So, and you all should wash your hands too. but we are so full of systems that inform how we act. And, you know, this is the systems of my friends and this is mine.
And we don't think a thing about it unless an outsider who doesn't do that would comment.
Absolutely.
On it.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah, right.
My guest today is Anna Buck, and her new book is titled Fisherman's Blues, A West African Community at Sea. I was really struck by, we're talking about rituals and beliefs, the luck of Captain Ndongo through the course of the book. He has some bad luck. It's like you find out he has one boat, and then you find out he has another boat, but the boat's laid up, a tree falls on it in a storm, and then he's clipped by another boat, and that goes out of commission. Then you find out he has a third boat, and it's also out of commission. He really had a tough time during the time, a good part of the time you were with him.
He actually had a loner that practically drowned. Yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's not even his boat, the third boat. That was a loner boat. That one day we came out to go fishing, and we couldn't find it because it was so awash that all you could see was the slight ellipse of, you know, one of the gunwales.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. And he has, you know, three wives and many children that he needs to, whom he needs to feed and support and provide for.
On a good day for one of these fishermen, are they set for a week? Are they set for a few days? Are they set for a month? Or is it more like, you know, they're on a good day that they can go out another day?
One fisherman told me, the sea brings forth the avarice of man. They will go out the next day. They will never stop for a week. They're never content. There's never enough fish. And that is something that I experienced when I was working on boats. It's this avarice that just unfurls when you're at sea. You just want. So if we think about the origin of all things alive that came out of the sea and how we came to be by eating one another and by gorging and by devouring, that is still very much, and you know, people may think that I'm talking about some kind of magic, but I think that this primeval desire for more is very present at sea. I have not met a captain who said, you know, this was a great day. Why don't I take a break? No, we're all going to go out the next day.
Yeah. No, that seems to be the case. What about 5 years from now, 10 years from now? What's the future hold for this group of fishermen? There's about a couple thousand boats, you know, probably 3,000 to 4,000 people, 5,000 people or more who depend who are actually about going out there. Yeah, 45,000, yeah. Depending on this industry. The whole city depends on the industry. What's the future like 4 or 5 years now? Because there are so many regulations. I'm seeing there are talk about closing a lot of the whole fishery to mm-hmm. all fishing because mm-hmm. it's so depleted.
Mm-hmm. I think the future very much depends on globally how we treat our ocean. It depends very much on how we treat the landlocked treat the
consumers.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Treat the ocean and treat our hunger for fish. It depends on how we regulate emissions and pollution, because a lot of the change at sea is not so much because of overfishing, but because of the changing salinity and temperature of the ocean, which is a direct result of climate change. So there's so much that all of us, including you, dear listeners, can do to change or alter the future, affect the future of Joël and Julien. So it's very hard to foretell if this is how we're going to keep treating our planet the way we treat it right now. Then 5 years from now, there still will be some fish, but it will not be a lot. 10 years from now, it's very hard to say what people will be fishing.
From the fishermen's perspective, did they just say, well, we'll just have to go further? We'll have to go further up the coast, down the coast, out to sea. Is that their mindset?
Yeah, and they also say that the sea fluctuates, which is true. And they believe that there are fluctuations in the sea that are so long that we cannot foretell them. And of course it's true, because there have been climatic events on this planet that have changed salinity of the sea and level of sea levels before. But, you know, in the near future, there is a sense of fatalism again, fisherman's fatalism. We'll just go harder.
Yeah. Well, it's a really interesting book, Fisherman's Blues. Anna Botkin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Botkin speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. The writer's a member of the Tulsa Artist Fellowship. Her latest book is a work of nonfiction, Fisherman's Blues, A West African Community at Sea. It's published by Riverhead Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Rigsby at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.